bit about your relationship with language, because you come back and you're working as an ESL teacher. So add Spanish into the mix, and you've got a really interesting conversation about language. What were some of your observations?
I think I started kind of intuitively noticing, and then later more overtly noticing, that language and accent particularly could place people into groups in the area that I come from, especially in an educational setting. So I realized at some point that the guys with the thickest accents were often the guys down on the vocational hall who were in the auto shop classes or the carpentry classes. And there seemed to be this kind of delineation of the way that you speak is going to predict your future. And I'm not sure that that should be the case, but maybe that's the way the world sometimes works. And so as a teenager, I decided that I was going to start cleaning up my language, because I was interested in literature and art and going to college. And to me, at the time, those things didn't seem like they could connect, or that they often did. And so I worked at first in a kind of probably, again, intuitive way, and then later in a kind of systematic way to start shaping up my language and maybe losing some of my accent, changing the way that I pronounce words, and continued that kind of through college. I was an English major and became a grammar geek, I guess. And then moving to Central America and spending most of my days speaking Spanish, I realized that when I was in that place, I was trying really hard to develop a colloquial language. I wanted to sound like everyone around me. I didn't want to sound like a textbook when I was speaking Spanish. And it started leading to a lot of questions about the beauty of the language and the accent of the region that I come from. And when I moved back, the year that the book takes place, I have to kind of deal with having worked to lose that accent, and in some ways losing the beauty of that language, and also potentially losing some identity. But it's a hard process to try to reclaim those sounds when you've sort of moved on, you've found a new voice.
Do you have any favorite words as far as the sound? Any words you find really particularly beautiful in the way that they are used where you're from, and words that you sort of reclaimed when you came back?
Yeah, I really like the word reckon and all of its uses. And it's a word that I don't feel like I can reclaim. I don't feel like I can pull it off anymore, even though my family says it. And in fact, I was just in Chattanooga a couple weeks ago and talking to a professor there who teaches fiction, who was from Chicago. And he said when he first moved to Chattanooga, his students were writing stories and they had their characters using words like reckon. And he was like, people don't really speak like that. You have to make this realistic. And he didn't realize that people really do in this region. His students had to sort of school him on the accuracies of the dialect. So that's a word that I think has just cool layers of meaning about if it's a guess or sort of estimate and ways of softening phrases. And I really like the phrase like to. Someone threw a ball at me and it liked to hit me. This kind of almost thing. That's another one that I don't feel like I can pull off, but it's such a colorful expression. We were talking about Ron Rash earlier, and he came to visit one of my classes a couple of weeks ago and was talking about language and saying that one of the things that's always been curious to him is that there is this stigma attached to a particularly Appalachian dialect. But what he's always been intrigued by are the ways that people use the language metaphorically. And to be able to use language metaphorically already implies a certain level of intelligence. So to be able to make those comparisons and to think in figurative ways. I find, now that I'm kind of back here and listening, that the language of this region is just filled with metaphor. It's a sort of constant comparison, and there are just tons of phrases like that.
In researching some of your family background, I think you do a nice job of showing that you really found individuals on both sides of a lot of these conflicts, the Civil War and the Trail of Tears and things like that. And how did that strike you when you discovered some of those things?
Well, I mean, like I said at the beginning of our conversation, I ask a lot of questions in the book, and I'm not sure how many answers I'm able to get to. But the bigger kind of guiding question of what does it mean to be a mountain person probably has a very long and complicated answer that I haven't quite sorted out. But one of the potential answers to that question that I began to learn as I looked into the history is that for a long time, this place has been kind of comfortable with a certain complication. So there have been, as you say, kind of competing histories and competing narratives and competing communities that have coexisted in the region for years. And it's not as though everyone's sitting around singing Kumbaya, but they're all able to kind of stake out their lives on the land and live in a way that is productive. And so that was kind of surprising to me, because I think the prevailing narrative about Appalachia is that it's a very kind of homogenous place that has been isolated. And maybe there's a little truth to both of those things, but certainly not as much as I had been led to believe. And I started looking into my history and finding, as you say, people fighting on both sides of the war, people fighting for very different kinds of reasons. And this is true of both the Revolution and the Civil War. The book that I'm working on now is about the diaries of my great-great-great-great-grandfather that I discovered recently. And he took part in the Trail of Tears, took part in the first stage of what was called then the Cherokee Removal, but also wrote sermons for most of the people in the community. And it's just a really complicated history. But that complication could be really useful, I think, to then sort out what we do with it now, especially as we have maybe less violent but still equally competing urges about how we use our land and what community looks like. And I think that the more that we have a sense of how the place has been able to, as I say in the book, kind of make a home of two minds, to be able to exist in the disconnect between these various histories, I think if we can do that, you know, today, we'll be all the better for it.
So you'll be in Greensboro in January, and part of the experience that someone will have when they go to see you at a reading is you will bring along your banjo, and specifically it's called a saga banjo, is that correct?
Yeah, the banjo that I had when I was 24, so the year that the book takes place, was called a saga. The banjo is an older form, so most people are probably familiar with the bluegrass style of banjo, which has this kind of resonator built on the back that rolls the sounds around, and what's often called Scruggs style after Earl Scruggs, the kind of three-finger picking style. I play an older form, so my banjo doesn't have a resonator. It's open back, and I play what's often called clawhammer or frailing on the banjo. So a lot of the songs are kind of pre-bluegrass songs, and many of them reach pretty far back into Appalachia and even all the way back to Scotland and Ireland. So what I've been doing for these readings is reading a bit from the book, but for me, our history is tied to music, and in many cases, the music helped me to understand the history, and so I've been playing a little bit from the banjo as a way of kind of nuancing that history and also my experience with it. When I moved back, I was trying to figure out if I really fit in that place, and so I decided, what more of an Appalachian thing could I do than buy a banjo and try to figure out how to play it? That suddenly kind of, not backfired, but I think complicated again the question, because I started learning that the banjo's roots actually reach into West Africa, and it was shaped by slavery and a lot of other factors before it became the instrument we know today. So even it has a very complicated history.
If you had been born somewhere else, would you have still felt this pull? Or is that pull unique to these mountains? Or, you know, is there something in you that is wired to want to understand place and its influence over who we are as people?
I think that, I mean, I hope that the book can communicate beyond the region, because I suspect that a lot of people have a very similar experience of leaving the place they're from and then suddenly asking lots of questions about it once they're gone. And those end up being kind of personal questions about how that place has shaped you and who you are. And so I find that I don't know that it's unique to the mountains. I think what makes it my experience maybe potentially different, and people who come from the region different, is that the mountains have so much kind of mystery around them. People are interested in them, but sometimes confused about them. And a lot of that has to do with prevailing stereotypes, I think, about people from the mountains. And this might be true, too, of say, the Ozarks, you know, in a very different part of the country, that mountains have been, in some ways, historically kind of separated from the rest of the world. And so the history there is harder to understand. And I think that it makes people a little more, maybe this is one of those stereotypes that has some truth to it. People are a little more standoffish about outsiders, but pretty connected to their community and their place. And so I think looking over the last 230 years that my family has been basically in Henderson County, it's easy to see that they abide, that they're very attached to that land. And I think that there are lots of places probably in the country and the world in which people have similar sentiments. But I think for the mountain region, there's this kind of like mystery that is hard to communicate once you get outside of it that sometimes sends people back.
Author Jeremy B. Jones. He holds an MFA in nonfiction writing from the University of Iowa. His essays have been recognized in Best American Essays, nominated for the Pushcart Prize, and awarded the Emma Bell Miles Prize. He currently teaches in the English department at Western Carolina University. In the new year, Jeremy will be reading and likely playing the banjo at Scuppernong Books on January 23rd at 7 p.m. Bearwalla was published by John F. Blair Publisher, an entity celebrating its 60th anniversary this year. To hear Jeremy read from Bearwalla, head to our website at wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.